This is Fresh Air. For most of us, Washington, D.C. means politics and power. Edward Jones has written about another side of life in our nation's capital. Lost in the City is a collection of 14 stories set in African-American neighborhoods in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The White House, the Capitol, and the Supreme Court seem very far away. The book is on the Washington Post's bestseller list. Jones spoke with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. First, he read an excerpt from his story, The Store. A young man is walking home after being fired from the job he held for 2 years at the Atlas Printing Company, a job where he never got a raise, where he saw young white men climb ahead of him to better positions, and where he was let go, the owner said, because of hard times. It's a freezing winter day.
My father always said that when the world pisses on you, it then spits on you to finish the job. At New York Avenue and Fifth, I crossed on the red light. A white cop twirling his billy club saw me and came to spit on me to finish up what Atlas had done. He asked me if I didn't know it was against D.C. and federal law to cross on the red light. I was only a few blocks from home, and maybe heat and thawing out my nuts were the only things on my mind, because I tried to be funny and told him the joke my father had always told, that I thought the green light was for white folks and the red light was for colored people. His face reddened big time. When my brother and I were in our early teens, my mother said this to us with the most seriousness she had ever said anything. Never, even if you become kings of the whole world, I don't want y'all messing with a white cop. The worst that my mother feared didn't happen to her baby boy that day. The cop only made me cross back on the green light and go all the way back to 7th Street, then come back to 5th Street and cross again on the green light, then go back to 7th to do it all over again. Then I had to do it twice more. I was frozen through and through when I got back to 5th the second time, and as I waited for the light to change after the fourth time, and he stood just behind me, I became very afraid that doing all that would not be enough for him, that he would want me to do more, and then even more after that, and that in the end I would be shot or simply freeze to death across the street from the number 2 police precinct. Had he told me to deny my mother and father, I think I would have done that too. I got across the street and went on my way, waiting for him to call me back. I prayed, just get me back to 115 New York Avenue safely, and I'll never come back to the world again. Just get me back to 115 New York Avenue safely. For days after that, I just hung out at home. My mother believed that a day had the best foundation if he had breakfast. So after she fixed our breakfast and went off to work, I went back to bed and slept to about noon. When I got some heart back, I started venturing out again, but I kept in my own neighborhood, my own world.
Okay, thank you, Ed Jones. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, boundaries and borders and people crossing over borders and boundaries and the consequences of that comes up a lot in your stories. What kinds of boundaries were you aware of when you were growing up?
I think there was never, for me when I was a kid, there was never a sense that of going into white neighborhoods because all the neighborhoods I knew were black. I think the adults in my life probably confronted racism and all of that. But for children, the world was a relatively safe place. We had our stores, we had playgrounds, we had friends. And beyond all of that, there were the adults in the neighborhood who watched out for kids. So it was a fairly safe place in your own neighborhood. And if you ventured too far beyond that, then you were in a different world and you might encounter something you might not like.
How big was your neighborhood? How much, was it your block? Was it a few blocks?
It could be a few blocks. It could be one particular block. When I was living, I lived in Washington. By the time I was 18, I lived in about 18 different places. So for me, growing up, I had a variety of neighborhoods. That was just, my mother didn't, her job, she worked as a dishwasher in a restaurant for most of my childhood. And she didn't get very much money, and the result was that we moved into places that weren't very good. If you moved, for example, into a place in spring, you didn't know until that winter that there was no heat. So we would end up moving out of that place into a still another place that had its own problem. So we moved around a lot. For me, a neighborhood could be one particular street. On K Street, I remember, it was just that street. And as it turned out, we moved around the corner to Myrtle Street, which is the street in the story, The Girl Who Raised Pigeons. But all the time I was on K Street for about 2 or so years, I never knew one single person around the corner on Myrtle Street.
I want to ask you a little bit more about boundaries. You said that in your world you felt safe, but that the adults around you, you could kind of sense that when they ventured out into the wider world, either for work or whatever, going into the white world. What did you pick up from that? What did you sense from them?
Did they tell you directly
that there was danger out there?
Yeah, I think, as a matter of fact, I don't think many of them read. They rarely talked about what happened on their jobs in Washington. A lot of the talk, a lot of the bad things that had happened to them in the South, because almost all the adults I knew as a child had come from the South. We were, I think, people of my generation were like the first to be born in Washington. Our parents, their friends, almost all the adults had come from the South. And so when they talked about bad things in the world, it was things in the South, racism, now and again things about the KKK, people having to flee because of this, that, and the other. But there was not very much talk. I mean, it was, as far as work in Washington, it was hard work and whatever, but they didn't really go into much talk about racism. I don't know why it is. I think because Washington was a predominantly black city, and even though there was segregation there in the early years when I was growing up, they came back to a world that was wonderful. I remember when I lived on 10th Street, we had on U Street 3 movie theaters, and they were, I can remember, they were just, they were well kept, there were good movies there, so everything you needed was in your own world. And I suppose that kind of made up for whatever bad things that happened to people when they went on their jobs.
Writer Edward Jones is our guest, speaking with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Edward Jones, author of the new book, Lost in the City. Speaking with him is Fresh Air producer Naomi Person.
You grew up in a neighborhood called Shaw, I believe?
A variety of neighborhoods, Shaw and other places, yeah.
Right. How far were you from official Washington, the power and buildings? And
actually, not very far. When I lived, for example, on 10th Street, I lived at a 1700 block of 10th Street. At about the 600 block is Ford's Theater and also the house where Lincoln was shot and killed. So relatives would come from out of town, and we would just walk all the way down 10th Street and start sightseeing right there at Ford's Theater and the house where Lincoln was shot. But after you cross a certain street, it depends on the street, then you would begin to see a number of more and more white people, and you would know you were no longer in your own neighborhood.
How did you feel? I mean, how did that feel? Did you have to change your behavior? Did you have to watch out for things? Comfortable? Was it uncomfortable?
I think because you're as a child, you know, there's a certain cockiness that goes with it. So we really didn't change our behavior very much because we hadn't learned that was what you should do. I was raised by my mother primarily, and my mother was a very gentle, and in some instances, she could be very meek. So she never really got around to telling me all the things that I should know about being in a white world. So we really weren't any different. We were just children.
Right.
I noticed when I remember in 1964, I went and visited South Boston, Virginia, and that was the summer that the Civil Rights Bill was passed. And I didn't think very much of it then. It was only years later that I began to see that it was a very different atmosphere down there. Because when I went to the theater, I had to sit in the balcony. And which was something very strange because in D.C., all our theaters, of course, were black, and you could sit wherever you want. I remember, too, that the day the Civil Rights Bill was passed, my cousins were very excited because now they could go to the white swimming pool. They didn't have any swimming pool of their own. And I couldn't share in their joy because I didn't understand what all the excitement was about. First of all, I was too young, and also I had come from Washington where you could go to any swimming pool practically that you wanted. Mm-hmm. It was just really strange to see them all so happy about something that I didn't think was a big deal.
Right. Did you participate at all, or were you too young to participate in some of the political protests and action, the Poor People's Campaign, Martin Luther King's March on Washington? Were you aware of those things?
I was too young for one thing, and I didn't have any political consciousness at that time. In 63, I believe it was, when they had the March on Washington, we had just gotten our first television set, a used thing, I think my mother bought for about $50. And because it was so, that started it, because it was so new, I think I ran in and out of the house that day, of our apartment that day, turning it on just to get, you know, this whole idea of a new television set. And all that day on the television, there was this march and these people making the speeches. But it had no relationship to me. I didn't feel that, you know, it was taking place, for example, way, way down at the Washington Monument. And it didn't mean anything to me because that, I had no idea what was going on.
It sounds in a lot of ways like you were really protected in your neighborhood. And you said that, you know, when you would walk into, you know, start walking into the white world, you hadn't learned about the white world. Like,
no.
Your mother never told you what you needed to know.
No.
When did you start learning?
I think in 1966, because that was the first year I really began to read a lot. Up until I was about 13 or 14, all I read was what was called funny books, which are comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think in 65 I was in Brooklyn, New York, and I read for the first time Native Son, and things began to. There was a sense there that there was something more that I didn't really know. And then in 66, I began to read a whole lot, particularly a lot of Southern authors. I remember I read a lot of Erskine Caldwell, and there was a book called A Hurry Sundown, which was a really big novel about the South and the civil rights movement, the civil rights era, and white and black characters. Also, I began high school, and I think things just began to open up. And they opened up even more when I went away to college in 68.
When you went away to college, you went to Holy Cross College?
In Worcester, Massachusetts.
In Worcester, Massachusetts. What was that like? I mean, Worcester is, kind of a working class town, about an hour or so from Boston.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It was, of course, first of all, I was homesick. I had never been away from home so long, so far away. And then there was this black kid who was used to being surrounded by black people. All of a sudden, I was surrounded by white people. It was just, the experience is, it was just like being taken out and just plunged into a totally, and at times hostile environment. And I think that was why there were about 50 or so black students at that time, and we kind of rallied around and kind of gave each other comfort. But it was, I had never, you know, my mother had never spoken to me about what I could expect, what would happen, because she was an undereducated woman. But I just sort of made my way as best I could.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your difficult experiences, your first, you know, experiences that you remember that you just kind of stopped yourself and said, you know, how did I end up here?
Yeah. My roommate was a white guy, and I don't remember what city he lived in, somewhere in Massachusetts, but whenever his parents would come and bring him something, they would always stay downstairs, and he never once introduced me to them. I went away one weekend, and I had a poster of Eldridge Cleaver on the front on my door, and some guy got drunk one night and decided to tear it down. There were just a few slights along the way. I remember I would stand in the French class, and this guy, we were standing in the back. I think we would recite the Lord's Prayer or something in the beginning of the class. And this guy would always turn around and look at me. I mean, it was just, his eyes told me, well, you're not really supposed to be there. And I think I made an effort that first semester to go to church, because I hadn't been going to church in many years. And I remember one evening I was in church, I think it was a midnight mass or something, and I saw this guy. He didn't see me. And it occurred to me, well, if he's here in church and I'm here in church, one of us really doesn't belong, and I never went back anymore.
I have a question for you about your mother. In hearing your stories about her and what she did and a lot of times did not tell you, it reminds me a lot of, you know, how a kid, when they either find out about sex from their parents or they don't. Did you ever kind of have a talk with her afterwards and kind of say what, you know, resolve that with her?
No, and I regret that. She died in 1975, and I regret that. That kind of feeling I wanted to put in the story of The Lost in the City, because, you know, once death happens, you know, all of that my mother was and knew, the woman she was lost, and I'm always aware of that now, particularly as the years go on and I get closer to the age she was when she died. And I put that feeling into the story that once, you know, that this woman is dead and now all of that is gone. But no, I never had any sit down and had any talk with her, and I regret that very, very much.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious also, there are a lot of writers in this country and who have sort of worked regional areas into their stories and kind of had that be the framework of their fiction. Were you influenced by any of these writers?
I didn't realize this until a few weeks ago. Someone had mentioned this. But the first time I read Joyce's Dubliners, something clicked in my mind, and I said, I want to do this for Washington, D.C., for the world that I knew. And I didn't, and that I think that happened so long ago that I'd simply forgotten that that had been the initial inspiration, because I didn't really have any stories in my head when I read Dubliners. I just knew that somewhere along the line I wanted to do that. But I think that was the beginning of it, when I read those stories and all those wonderful people in Dublin. And I knew that, you know, that just as many wonderful people were living in Washington. Of course, you never hear about it because all you hear about is Capitol Hill, White House, the politicians, etc. But I knew there was a variety of people, wonderful people in Washington, and I wanted to do the same thing that Joyce had done.
Edward Jones' new collection of short stories is called Lost in the City. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. This is Fresh Air.